In addition to thinking about our ancestors last week, we also made a pledge and blessed our ballots, and I'm not going to think anything less of you one way or the other, but if you voted, let's raise your hands. All right. And if you know you're going to vote, raise your hands. All right, it looks like 100% again. That's what we're going for. It took a long time, as many of you know, to fill out those 3 pages of this year's ballot. And we, myself, Michael, my husband, and Catherine, my adult daughter, who lives with us, had different conversations as each of us filled it out at different times. Each of us knew something in particular that we wanted the other to vote for or against. Each of us had a piece of knowledge about a judge or a candidate or a referendum that the others didn't have. And more than ever, since I first voted in 1976 when I was 18, I worried that each of our ballots might not be somehow counted, that something might be lost. And on my way to church this morning, I heard that that's a common fear this year. And more than ever, I wondered if the people, our citizens, the full electorate, would accept the outcomes this Tuesday, as long as it did seem that they were counted freely and clearly of any fraud. It has seemed harder and harder every other election year to accept the outcomes by at least some portion of the country. And there have been some very close races, some decided by only a few votes. One election was even tied and they tossed a coin. And others have seemed murky or hijacked, whether looking at the popular vote versus the Electoral College in the last presidential election, or the hanging chads of the Gore-Bush election, effectively decided by the Supreme Court in the year 2000, like the second year of this church's life. Without exception, every election year has been hard in our Prairie community, with many of our people swaying from joy to despair and back again through the years. We may have forgotten, or perhaps we took for granted, the fragile ecosystem of our democracy. It requires a faith in the election process, participation by all people who consider themselves citizens, fair access to the ballot box, and an agreement to allow for the majority to have their say and the rule, at least for this day. Democracy is still an experiment, and this country is still its model. And it takes a lot of faith and courage to stand together as a people behind an idea, especially when we disagree, sometimes vehemently. Other nations, especially in Europe and Asia, are based on ethnicity, often with the name of the country, its people, and language all being the same. The United States is the first country based on the idea of democracy, with its constitution being its practical religion, including the idea that different religious people and different ethnicities can live here, so that we have Irish Americans, Syrian Americans, and Japanese Americans. Yale Law professors Amy Chu and Jeb Rubenfield write in the October Atlantic magazine, whose cover question asks, "Is democracy dying?" In comparison, they say there is really no such thing as an Irish-French person or a Japanese-Chinese person, meaning if you live there, you are French or you are Chinese. Chu and Rubenfield are the authors of the article on tribalism, one of the issues that is dividing our country and threatening the idea of democracy, both from the right and from the left. If you read this magazine, you know I can't possibly begin to say all that it covers, and it deals with everything from the international stage to our courts. But it names as the main threats to democracy, 1, tribalism, 2, the decline of democratic institutions, and the loss of what it is to be a citizen practicing democracy, 3, the continued inequality based on race in our society, and 4, the rise of mob passion. And I want you to stick with me, because that's not the mobs that we are hearing about and seeing that are protesting what they believe in. We're talking about social media mob. the social media mob. That's for you. Tribalism has become a common topic of conversation this political season. And as we know, instead of tribes based on ethnicity or religion, we have come to have tribes based upon political parties. John Adams and George Washington both warned against strong parties because they could divide the country, and they could even tear our country down. But as we know, strong parties quickly emerged, almost from the beginning, and it's actually hard to imagine our elections without them. But we are living in a time when the separation between the two sides is as divided and polarized as it was during the Civil War. The causes of America's resurgent tribalism are many, Chu and Rosenfield write. They include seismic demographic change, which has led to predictions that whites will lose their majority status within a few decades. Declining social mobility and a growing class divide, and media that reward expressions of outrage. They continue that all of this has contributed to a climate in which every group in America, minorities and whites, conservatives and liberals, the working class and elites, feels under attack, pitted against the others, not just for jobs and for spoils, but for the right to define the nation's identity. In these conditions, democracy devolves into a zero-sum competition, one in which parties succeed by stoking voters' fears and appealing to their ugliest us versus them instincts. In the article, they point out that on the left, there is a historical critique that challenges everything about the Constitution and democracy because it was developed by white, landed, slave-owning males bent upon upholding their economic status and white supremacy, so much so that it seems that there are no tools or values that people can have faith in anymore. And on the right, there is the movement to define true Americans as white and Christian, code for white nationalism with its virulent racism. Chu and Rosenfield conclude, there are lessons here for both the left and the right. The right needs to recognize that making good on the Constitution's promises requires much more than flag waving. If millions of people believe that because of the color of their skin or religion, they are not treated equally, how can they be expected to see the Constitution's resounding principles as anything but hollow? For its part, and I hope you disagree with some of the things that I'm going to say today, that's what we're going to talk about in our conversation. For its part, the left needs to rethink its scorched earth approach to American history and ideals. Exposing injustice, past and present, is important, but there is a world of difference between saying that America has repeatedly failed to live up to its constitutional principles and saying that those principles are lies or smoke screens of oppression. Washington and Jefferson were slave owners. They were also political visionaries who helped give birth to what would become the most inclusive form of governance in the world, they conclude. Today's tribalism has emerged in a time of cultural change in which younger people are either disillusioned or uneducated about the fabric and idea of democracy. And many people have stopped practicing it in their daily lives. The founders knew that if a people were to govern themselves, even as a democratic republic where leaders were elected, that they would need to be educated and to appreciate the value of their vote. Early American culture, especially through the 19th century, was a country of joiners and a country of many presidents. Everything from the PTA to the NAACP, from corporate businesses to volunteer fire departments, were run by boards with votes on policies and laws and procedures. Our Unitarian Universalist Church is run as a democracy, too. At least twice a year, this congregation votes on important matters of budget, policy, direction, and leadership. Of course, most kinds of churches and religious institutions aren't that democratic, but at least here, you can practice democracy. And this is important, for as Robert Putnam found in Bowling Alone, many Americans have become civically disengaged, and many younger people apparently no longer believe in democracy. In 2011, about a quarter of American millennials said that democracy was a bad or a very bad way to run a country, and that it was unimportant to choose leaders in free and fair elections, writes Yanni Applebaum in an article entitled Losing the Democratic Habit. Another survey finds that only 30% of Americans born in the 1980s, only 30% of those born in the 1980s, believe that living in a democracy is essential, compared with 72% of Americans born in the 1930s. Applebaum goes back, you might say, to the basics, and recommends that extracurricular school activities should be considered more a part of the curriculum, not to have just more civics classes, because it is in all those clubs and sports and other activities that children and youth can learn the arts of making rules, voting, changing, and creating their own many institutions and cultures. Applebaum points out that democracy is not the easiest or most efficient way to run something. Anyone who's been to a zoning hearing in their city knows that. But its value lies instead in harmonizing discordant interests and empowering constituents. Applebaum concludes, the American system of government functions properly only when embedded in a culture deeply committed to democracy. That culture sustains the Constitution, not the other way around. As mentioned in the tribalism article, systemic racism is still alive and well and affecting millions of people. We have talked about that reality in this church many times, fighting against the myth that we are now living in a so-called post-racial society, something that has become almost impossible to believe, I think, in most of the last 2 to 3 years. Our Justice League has racial justice as one of its top priorities, along with mental health and economic justice, and all three are deeply interrelated. Ibram X. Kendi, director of the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center at American University, and author of Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America, I haven't read that, but I really want to, he writes that learning to be anti-racist is the primary solution to this societal ill. Because it will help us reveal our own racism and the racism embedded in our many institutions, which continue to benefit white people over black and brown people, or target people of color disproportionately, such as in the criminal justice system. Now here I'm going to go local and personal. I want to say that anti-racist work is incredibly hard. Together Colorado, one of this church's justice partners, has committed itself to becoming anti-racist in the past 2 years. We meet in white and people of color caucuses, trying to actually find a way to really trusting one another across the racial divides. Because of our work, one of our African American ministers shared with us the tragedy of her 17-year-old son being arrested one night last May, basically for being a young black man out walking wearing a gray hoodie. While he was being held in the patrol car that night, not knowing why he had been picked up, by the way, another policewoman brought the Latina victim to him. They shined their patrol car lights on the young man, and the woman pointed him out as one of two black men who had earlier tried to steal her truck. In the pretrial hearing earlier this week, The woman testified that the only distinguishing facial feature she could remember about the perpetrators was that they were black. She also wasn't wearing her glasses. The prosecutor has already conceded that this show-up eyewitness identification, apparently a common practice of the police, was unnecessarily suggestive, and we are hoping the identification is eventually thrown out, which should end the case because there is no other evidence against my friend's son. As we were leaving the courthouse, her husband, also a minister, told me that he has never expected justice in all the 60 years of his life. Learning to be anti-racist, like any practice, is also about learning to walk the talk. This is the commitment of this church, our larger Unitarian Universalist Association as well. Fighting racism isn't just the right thing to do. It is necessary to putting that puzzle back together of our country so that it might live into its values, including those stated in the Constitution. And I would be remiss if I didn't ask you to vote for Amendment A, if you haven't already voted, which would take the exception to slavery out of our Colorado Constitution. The exception to slavery is an echo of this country's 13th Amendment, which passed in 1865, which was meant, and everyone thinks it did, abolish slavery, but it says that this is true except when someone is duly convicted of a crime, a concession which would allow the South then to re-enslave any black person arrested and convicted, which was practically a fait accompli after the Civil War and throughout Jim Crow. And I don't think I have to point out how my story shows it's still today. I will end this reflection with a concern about mob rule. Our founders, but especially Madison, feared that if people were asked to govern themselves, they did not trust the people, by the way, they might be ruled by their passions instead of reason. They might become a mob. People, remember, had never ruled themselves before. They had mostly been ruled by monarchs or military dictators, and the people, especially the poor and hungry, had been known to become rioting mobs. Jeffrey Rosen, a contributing editor of The Atlantic and a law professor at George Washington University, writes that the digital age has brought us into a Madisonian nightmare, led at times by an imperial president, something that has been developing since the populists Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson insisted that they derive their authority directly from the people, creating the potential for a combo the founders had hoped to avoid, a demagogue with a mob. Rosen writes, Twitter, Facebook, and other platforms have accelerated public discourse to warp speed, creating virtual versions of the mob. Inflammatory posts based on passion travel farther and faster than arguments based on reason. Rather than encouraging deliberation, the foundation of democracy, mass media undermine it by creating bubbles and echo chambers in which citizens see only those opinions they already embrace. I saw some smiles out there. We know that that's true. And there was that word again, citizen. We will continue this reflection, as I've mentioned, during learning hour, but perhaps the greatest challenge raised by today's question, is democracy dying, is what does it mean to be a good citizen today? Are we up for the task? Do we still remember what it really means to be a patriot? What values do we want to live by and carry with us out into the public square? Can we still imagine something larger than ourselves, the common good? May we begin to find these answers here in this faith which grew up beside our democracy and which has always tried to reflect the best of what we could possibly be. Amen.